This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we have our usual sponsors for the show. That's our good friends at Jamf Software, makers of the Jamf Pro and Jamf Now MDM solutions for Mac, iPad, iPhone, and Apple TV. We'll tell you more about that later on. Bradley, how's it going?
Great. We are at fall break for our school, which means roughly 25% of the school year is coming on. It's crazy.
Frightening how fast it's going, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's funny. I finally had a use today for the Puffin browser. Do you heard of that? And we have...
Yeah, we use it in school sometimes.
Yeah, we have this like progress test that we give to like kindergartners and first graders, and they still have like no plans for iPad. It's like still Flash-based, you know, even though Flash is end of life in about 2.5 years. So, not even end of life. Like, they don't distribute it anymore. So, it's, like, really end of life now.
Yeah, you better get some plans pretty quick if you don't have them.
Right. And so, we deployed it, and it really worked well. I mean, I think it's the Puffin browser is probably built for things like this versus, like, heavy games.
Yeah. It's not good for interactive stuff.
Yeah. So,
like, really fast interactive stuff.
So, do you listen to the Reply All podcast from Gimlet Media?
I do not know.
So, there was an episode, and we'll drop a link into the show notes, about somebody, like, had this old Flash game, like, from when they're, like, in, like, high school or college, and, like, they couldn't find it anymore. And, like, the show did some researching and found it, like, the source code, and then paid somebody to, like, make it work again. Really interesting story, but it really shows like the fragility of all things Flash.
Yeah, and I suppose that's also true for iOS. I mean, we did the iOS 11 transition recently, and one of my colleagues had about 30 apps from she's a biology teacher, so she had a lot of kind of remember those early apps that came out for like, here's an animation of the heart on your iPhone and stuff. She had a lot of those kicking about, and she had about 30 apps that just don't work anymore. You know, there's a lot of stuff starting to fall away.
Yeah, and that's, I don't know, that's, it is the life we live, and there's really no good way to archive those, except keeping old devices around. Anyways, I've got some good feedback from our last show, and do you want to give some follow-up from that discussion?
Yeah, so basically we went ahead with the project. We were close to doing it when we recorded the last show, but we had... My office is now full of boxes. We've got, what did we get? We got one 24-port Ubiquiti switch and two 8-port switches. So they're basically for the three floors of the building. So the two smaller switches will go on the first and second floors, and the 24-port switch will basically run the show on the ground floor. We got a security gateway device, and we got 20 access points. We went for the APAC Pro, which is the kind of... not the most cutting edge one, but it's the kind of workhorse one for schools, if you like. And we received all the equipment on Monday. All of it showed up with European plugs on it for some reason. I'm not sure why. So I chased the supplier, and they sent me a bunch of UK plugs, but they sent me Euro plugs with little like pin adapters on them. They're like, this is my core network. I'm not gonna put these 50 pence pin adapters into the wall for that. So that was that. The access points, I think we mentioned last week, come without PoE injectors. So we're going to try and make sure that everything's running off a switch rather than running off intermediate hubs. Can't quite do that everywhere. There's one place where it's not quite as helpful as I want it to be. So I might have one or two injectors still around. But in general, I've started the build and it's going pretty well. So I wonder if you wanted maybe some details on just how that's starting to roll out.
One thing is you mentioned a hub. That's not like a real hub, right?
No. I mean, like an unmanaged switch is what I meant to
say. Gotcha. I was like, it's like we're going to have
intermission. It's not 1996 anymore. Yeah. Like, where would you even get one of them? I don't know. We've got a couple of unmanaged hubs that kick around, and we're trying to minimize the number of them, but there's one or two places just where the way the wires go, we don't actually have a straight run from one end to the other. So, we're going to fix that a little bit.
So give us some more details about your setup. Like, first of all, what did you end up doing with your controller?
Yeah, so we mentioned last show the Ubiquiti Cloud Key, which is a kind of small Raspberry Pi type thing on a PoE connection. We didn't go for that. We decided we were going to put the controller on AWS because A, I love AWS, and B, I don't really want any critical software, hardware stuff in the building if I can avoid it. So that's out there. I tried to put it on the same virtual machine as our GSS, but they both want certain ports and stuff like that. So I was going to have to redirect one or other thing. I just thought, you know, this is easier and cleaner and a bit safer as well, I think, if we just have two instances running. And also the Ubiquiti controller at the moment, although I'm aware it's not loaded very heavily right now, seems to be able to run on a smaller instance than the GSS. The GSS uses a T2 small instance, but I've got the controllers running on a T2 micro at the moment, which is the second smallest. There's a nano one, which is absolutely tiny. I doubt you could run any Java application on that, but the T2 micro seems to be okay for now for the Ubiquiti controller. Gave it a domain name for our in our school domain, and that's been up and running for a few days now. It seems to be working great. So the next step from that was to go ahead and install the gateway if I could. And I sort of got that right the first try and sort of didn't. I had to back it out, and then at about 5 to 9 one morning, I realized something was wrong with the way DNS was working, so I had to quickly plug back everything back in. But then the next day I got it right. So we've now got the old network. The security gateway, for people who don't know, is basically a small router with three ports on it. One is your WAN port, and then there's two LAN ports. So I've got our new stuff in port one, and I've got one single connection. The cable that used to go into our cable modem now goes into the second port on the Ubiquiti security gateway. So that is basically emulating the DHCP and NAT functions from the Airport Extreme that we used to have. And our existing network now runs as it used to run, and I've got the new one kind of building up beside it so that we're not really interfering with anybody's work while we start to build out the new network. So that part's worked really quite well.
Well, and that's it's a really smart way to do it, because in an ideal world, you would just come in on a weekend and rip and replace. I mean, that would be obviously the ideal way, or over some sort of holiday. But by doing it slowly, I feel like you're going to make better decisions on like the way you're cabling and the way you're laying things out and the way you're configuring everything. Because it's like, if you get to a situation where it's like, oh crap, I need this, you got to order something. Yeah. You're not like haphazardly trying to make something work, because it's like Mondays are coming.
And you're not against the clock.
Right. You know? And it's like, you can kind of methodically work your way through this. And if you need to research something and wait for somebody on a Mac admin Slack channel to follow back up with you with best practices here, you can take the time to do that.
Yeah, there will be a couple of breakpoints in that where we have to kind of commit. And one of them is when we put those two other switches in, we're going to have to take that cabling that is in the wall and then goes up the side of the building. And we're going to have to take that and put that into the new network. So there will come a point where we have to flip over. But we're going to try and keep everything in place so that we could, in principle, just swap a couple of cables and get the old system back up and running if we really need to, if we start to run out of time. It's quite helpful because we're 2 days away from a holiday, and then we've got 2 weeks. So we're going to spend a lot of time tomorrow putting things on the wall, putting access points on the wall, and running cable back to switches and things like that. And then hopefully during the holidays we'll manage to switch over all the connections and install the switches and so on. So that should work out okay.
Now, will you run this cabling yourself, or will you sub that out to a subcontractor?
We've got a couple of guys who work with us just doing various maintenance stuff, and these are the same guys who put the first cables in, so they actually know better than I do where we can run these things. There's actually one room that we've brought into use that wasn't used before in the building, and we were having a conversation today, and I was like, where does that cable go? And our building guy, he said, yeah, if you go up here through this part, follow this pipe down here. And I was like, there's all parts of the building I've never been in. And he's like, yeah, I can run that cable, no problem. So it's pretty good. Because that's expensive if you've got to pay for that stuff.
Well, and we run into that too. And we don't do a lot of cabling runs in-house. We've just got too much. Our campus is just too big, and we don't have a large enough maintenance staff to like, hey, I need you to run 50 cables for me, or, you know, something like that. But I have got into a habit of relying on the same vendors over and over again. So I don't just call like any electrician in to come do that. Even if it's a commercial electrician, obviously we often need commercial vendors. The company we use, I mean, they've been working with our building for 20 years. And so they know the pitfalls. And so it just makes it where like things you didn't think possible are possible. And then, like you said, it just saves you money because you're often paying per hour and they're not like going the wrong ways, basically, or, you know, trying to find out the way. They know the way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a huge part of what we're doing in this project is just replacing like for like, or putting things in where there was cabling before for our desktop infrastructure that we used to have years ago. So there's actually a lot of dark cable in our building that we haven't really used in a number of years, and a lot of that will be coming back into use with this project. So it's quite helpful. You know, there's not a huge amount of new. There's only two rooms actually, and we reasonably know where we're going to put that stuff. So they'll actually end up being the neatest ones in the building, because all of our other rooms have got sort of desktop level wall plates. So we're going to have to run cable up the wall in almost every room. But these ones, we can actually run the cable into the ceiling and just put the access point right up there. So yeah, they're going to have the nicest deployments.
And those ones that are in the wall, could you not pull those just out of the wall plate and pull them back up from the ceiling?
We probably could. But in the interest of time and future flexibility, I'm probably going to surface mount from the wall to the access points. Just because I'm also not that sure about disturbing the cable that's in the wall. You know, do I want to start yanking that out and bending it and so on? I might want to just leave it where it is. And I've got a new cable to do the other part, so we'll maybe just do it that way.
Very cool. Yeah, no, it's tough. I mean, I would love to have the benefit of doing like building a school from scratch with cabling. But that's just not often the reality like most people live in. I mean, most schools are old and they have old buildings, and that's the challenge you have.
Yeah, I mean, if I had a summer holiday to do this, I would be thinking a lot harder about some of those cable runs, because I know some of them are very, you know, they're close to heat sources or things like that, you know, and don't mean like burning sources, but, you know, a pipe or something that might age the cable a little bit faster and things like that. And I'll be thinking a wee bit harder about some of that stuff. But for now, given the time I've got to do it and the fact that I want it done pretty quickly, then that's what I'm going to do.
All right. Before we move on, let's thank our friends at Jamf for sponsoring the show. If you're new to the show or just getting set up with iPad management, we love Jamf software for managing your Apple devices. We think it's the best solution for deploying and managing and securing your devices. Over 3 million students are empowered by use of Jamf every day. You bring learning to a whole new level for your students by providing the tools they need in today's classrooms. Start a free trial at jamf.com. That's JAMF.com. Thanks to Jamf for sponsoring Out of School this week.
Cool. So maybe a couple of reflections just on the switches and the APs as well, if you're interested. Yeah. The switches are crazy impressive. They're really solidly built, nice and heavy, and also very quiet, which is really important because two of these are going in classrooms. And I know I used to have the classroom with the big switch in it, and eventually I went and took the fan out of the switch because it drove me mad. These ones are a lot nicer in that respect, and they seem to have, you know, they're literally 10 years older than the last switch that we bought. They have sort of variable speed fans and things in them as well. So they're typically quite quiet, and then, you know, they can boost up if they need to. We haven't actually properly installed anything yet physically, but I've sort of done a desktop setup, if you like. You know, I've got one port, and I've put together the big switch and one of the little switches, and I've got basically the new network exists at my desk and nowhere else at the moment. So I'm using that as just a workstation to go through and adopt all the equipment. So adoption is Ubiquiti's term for taking an unconfigured device into your management system. And because we're running our controller outside of the school on a different IP, we have to do what's called layer 3 adoption. So we have to, for the first couple of units, for the security gateway and the first switch, you have to SSH into the switch and tell it where this thing called its inform URL is. And inform is their word for sending a broadcast to the controller to say, hey, I'm here, I'm unconfigured, can you help me with a configuration? So you do that for the first couple, but then after that, with the access points, if you're plugging them into the Ubiquiti switch, it can tell them where to go for the controller. So I've only had to do that once or twice, and then 20 access points just configured without any of that SSH business for them. So,
well, that's nice. You're not having to, like, every device, you're not having to do that. I guess they sense, like, the AP would find the switches, and that gets them home.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. And there are ways you can like copy the configuration from one to another. I haven't done any special configuration except just to name the access points in the controller and update their firmware so far, and obviously physically label them as well. I mean, this is my number one pro tip for sysadmin, is just label stuff like an obsessive person. So I did that. And so we know where all of those units are going now, and they'll all get to the right place, and they'll be named correctly in the controller as soon as they show up and things like that. So that worked really well. The APs, we've got 20, and I've got 19 planned locations so far. And that last one, don't know what I'm going to do with it, but I'll keep that around in case I need more coverage somewhere else, I suppose.
Well, it always would be helpful to have, because they're inexpensive enough, you could have one or two little spares on the shelf in case you had one die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we did get some feedback on the last show when we were talking about warranty and things like that. People were saying, look, it's way cheaper just to buy a new kit than to pay for any kind of warranty on these things. So that's what I'll do. I'll just have that one sitting there, and if I need some extra power somewhere, or maybe if there's an event on or something where I know there's going to be more devices in a room than I would normally expect, we can do that as well. And the fun thing is, I suggested this to our buildings guy. I said, look, these things are outdoor rated, how about we put one in the playground? And he's like, no. So they are outdoor rated, actually. They come with a waterproof plug for the back of it as well, but I don't think we're going to do that right now.
Yeah, so I guess same thing as the switch, is you're just plugging it in, and if you know, because you've already got a switch online and the security gateway online, it just shows up in your management system.
Exactly. Yep. And it shows up and it just says needs adoption. You just press the adopt button. You can then name it in the interface, give it it's called an alias in Ubiquiti. And then it takes a little while for them to be adopted, and then they show up. The controller knows that it's not in the latest firmware, so you can just hit an upgrade button. Ubiquiti also has a system called rolling upgrade, which I'm not totally sure where that is, but I suspect what it means is, like, if you ever, as you connect APs that don't have the latest firmware, they just automatically get it. So I didn't press that button. I did it manually for today, but I'll keep my eye on that and see what it's for when time comes.
Yeah, that's true. And that's, you know, do you know how the firmware updates go? Like, if you wanted to, say, update 5 of your 20, are you able to do that? Or is it like a one-stop shop? Like, when it's firmware upgrade time, it goes to every AP?
I think the rolling upgrade would probably go to everyone. But you could manually just press the update button on a few if you wanted to and see how it went.
Yeah, very cool. Sounds like a great setup. And it sounds like a simple deployment as well. Like, it's not too terribly complicated, especially once you get the first devices
online.
So far.
The way you do it is you define networks and Wi-Fi networks separately. So you can have, like, subnets that you build up. So I obviously built two subnets, one for the management network and one for the emulation of our old network on different subnets. And then you can also create VLANs as well. There's a couple of different ways. I was experimenting with this. There's a couple of different ways that you can do VLANs in Ubiquiti. One of them is you just create a VLAN and it just tags traffic. Now, in brackets, I don't really understand VLANs, but this is my best understanding. You can just tag traffic, and if you connect to a certain SSID, your traffic gets tagged with a certain VLAN ID, and that's all that happens. But it's still the one subnet. But there's another way you can do it, where you create multiple networks and each one of those networks becomes associated with a VLAN tag, so that if you connect to the student SSID, you get an IP address in a certain range, and if you connect to the staff one, you get an IP address in a different range. So that's the way I've done it, because we're getting close to 200 devices on the network. I wanted just to, you know, space it out a little bit and give a little bit more breathing room for IP addresses. So staff will go one way, students will go the other way, and neither one of them will have access to, for example, the management interface of any of these devices, so we can keep a bit more security as well.
Now, what is handling your DHCP? Is it your security gateway?
Yes. Yeah, the security gateway can run DHCP for all the subnets, and I think the inter-VLAN routing actually goes through the security gateway as well. Couldn't promise that for sure. But as we're sort of decommissioning Apple TVs as well, and all of our printing goes through a print server now, which is just a Mac Mini, but it runs Printopia. So this is me thinking out loud about VLANs, but if the print server's on a trunk port, we don't really care about Apple TVs that much anymore. They tend to work directly anyway. Inter VLAN bonjour traffic is not as important as it used to be, I don't think. And I need to test a couple of things. I need to test things like Apple Classroom. I need to just check how that works as well. May have to do a bit more work on that, but I think in general it's going to work out pretty well.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I think it'll be fun, like 6 months from now, to like kind of recap, like, where are you at? Yeah. Is there anything, like, as you brought it online and gone through class after class, like, is there anything that's working differently, better, worse? And just to kind of compare, setups.
I'm intensely aware that we haven't loaded this yet, and this is all very theoretical. So we'll have to just, the Monday we come back from those holidays, I'm going to be sitting there staring at that dashboard all day, just making sure that everything's going okay. So are you going to say something else here, Bradley?
No, I mean, the thing, I being in like a network admin role, the morning you wake up of like a thing of like that being live is exciting and scary all at the same time. Because like it's like fun. I mean, this is the part that is fun in some ways, like the configuring and watching your dashboard fill up with devices and getting them even put out. Like, that's fun because it sort of does just work. It is kind of scary when the things do start to see actual load.
Yeah. I mean, it's when everything's on brand new cables on my desk, everything works perfectly. But, there's maybe one cable that's not quite terminated correctly somewhere in the building, or blah, blah, blah. A mouse has nibbled through one cable or something. That's when you start to see anomalous things happen. Like, why is one access point offline when it should be online, and so on? So it's going to be helpful to have the switches in there though, because you can look at the switch status, you can look at the AP status, and you can sort of roughly have a go at guessing what's going on. So that's going to be quite good. I tested also, Bradley, I remember I told you about the trick about sending out the new SSID information in a profile. That worked perfectly. So I shut down our old SSID from the Aerohive stuff, brought up just one access point in one classroom with the new SSID, and grabbed a couple of kids' iPads, and they all switched over to the new network without a hitch. So I'm hoping that we can do this without having to touch any student iPad. I think we probably are going to get that. So fingers crossed.
Yes. Yeah, that's always the tricky part. It's like one of those things where it could like mostly work, but most of the time in this situation, it's either going to really, really work well, or it's just going to fall apart on day one. And over time, you'll see where, like, okay, a certain load doesn't work. But it's like one of those things when you walk into school and like pick up your iPad and you have a Wi-Fi connection, you breathe a little bit of sigh of relief.
Yeah, every time I'm making coffee first thing in the morning, I check that as well and just make sure. I mean, that's one other thing I need to think about, which I haven't really thought about yet, is channel planning and what devices are going to be on which channels. But I think I need to wait and get them all in place and then turn them on and see how much power these things produce and where it all goes and things like that. But I'm already looking at having the 2.4 radios on very low power and maybe the 5 gigahertz radios on slightly higher power. Hopefully trying to keep most of it in the room as much as I can. Because we've got enough radios now, I no longer need to blast through a wall to try and get to another classroom. So we can hopefully go for low power as much as possible.
Well, it's going to be... I can't wait to hear. It's like I'm excited for you.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. I mean, this is the kind of stuff I really enjoy. It's pretty great.
We'll keep covering. We'll keep circling back on Cedar's network overhaul as well. Next tonight, we wanted to talk about digital succession plans. And this has become near and dear to my heart a little bit, because we had a staff member pass away about a year and a half ago, or a little over a year ago, suddenly of a heart attack. And so it is difficult to piece that together. Now, it's even harder if that person is involved in IT, because if there's only, like, if it's a one person IT person, do you have things documented, how things are put, you know, how the pieces are built.
Yeah, they're all, a lot of that can be in your head as well. You know, I've recently handed over even just a single class to another teacher, and see the number of things that I had in my head about how that class worked that I've had to sit down and tell her has been just unbelievable to me. I never really thought about it enough. And when it comes to IT as well, like we were saying, you know, where are the cables in the building? Where do they run? Which, because I've got this one situation with a new network where I've got a classroom on one floor that will actually be fed from a switch on another floor. And I'm trying to do it, build it in layers, you know, this floor, this floor, this floor. But I've got these two classrooms side by side, both of which are actually going to be run off completely different switches. Stuff like that, you know, where's that all written down? So obviously you would want it to be documented somewhere. But the problem is that even if you document it, those documents tend to be digital and they tend to be secured behind passwords and shared drives and things. And are they shared with the right people, for example? So succession planning is becoming increasingly important, I think, in the digital world, as our security gets better as well.
Well, and that's the problem you mentioned is like you, this obviously is like keys to the kingdom. And so you obviously want it to be secure. And I've got one on file. It's like stored in my like personnel file with human resources. And my main goal was A, to document everything, but was also to help provide understanding of like who could help in the short term. Like, here's a list of vendors who could help with this. Like, here's who we use for this. Because obviously, like, you're not going to hire someone day one, but you may need to know who to call to like, hey, we got a website problem. Like, we don't want to change some on the website. Where's the website at? Who could we call to help fix that?
I've dealt with some of that by training up our secretary on editing the website and things like that as well. So I do have some services where there are multiple admins, but we're certainly not there for everything yet. And any of the more technical stuff like the Wi-Fi that I'm just building out of my head, and, you know, the internet connection itself, and the GSS, you know, the device management system, how does that all work? You know, that's all more or less in my head.
And, you know, another thing that like, it's going to sound dumb, but like my big fear, personally, like if I pass away, is like all of our pictures and making sure my wife would not know how to get access to those. And so like my pictures are stored in iCloud photo library and also in Google Photos as well. And like Backblaze and clones and et cetera, et cetera. But the problem is a lot of these services that I have are secured by two-factor authentication, which is inside of like my 1Password. And so like I've given my wife there's a note that she has access to that Hank has where all this is laid out, and also like talks about like here are where backup drives are that you could just get to raw files and then like which friend to call to help you sort through it. But that's my big concern, is like that all my pictures aren't like locked away in my iCloud account forever.
These are the things that you think about, you know, as part of succession planning. You've got to think, what are the systems, but also what is the data that I want to save? And different people are going to want different data, right? So, for example, in school, we're making increasing use of Google Team Drives to try and share the access to some of that stuff now. And that's helping quite a lot, because previously it was always like, I would make the shared folder and I would own it and I would share it with everybody that needed to share it. But then that's everything becomes sort of single point of failure on my account because I own all those files. Whereas with Team Drive, for example, you can say, well, here are all these people have got access to it, and the files are essentially owned by the Team Drive, and anybody who's in that Team Drive has got access at some level. So I guess, I mean, where do we start with this, right? I suppose, where do you keep your passwords is the first question, right? And I would hope that a lot of people are using 1Password. If you've not looked into 1Password for Teams or 1Password for families, that would be a good thing to do, because that is a really great service, particularly for families. It's not expensive and it's very, very, very worthwhile. So that's how I start, Bradley. I'm guessing you start probably somewhere similar, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously everything is in 1Password, but I think the key, like you mentioned, is somebody would know how to get into your 1Password and like how to retrieve the two-factor codes or retrieve the password. Now, when it comes to things like your G Suite, do you have anybody else in your organization that's the like super administrator?
Anybody else that's a super admin? No, it's just me.
So that's the thing I've always struggled with, is I did that one time, and then like someone accidentally installed like a add-on for everybody in the organization, and I've really been hesitant. Like, I mean, I've really just been hesitant to do that because you could really screw things up if you don't know what you're doing in the Google G Suite admin password.
Yeah, in a permanent way. Yeah, yeah. That's always been my concern as well. But if you are in a situation, as we are both and many other schools are as well, where you maybe only have one technical person in the whole organization, then do you want to have some other person who's very non-technical with root access to your cloud systems? And the answer is clearly no, right? So I've taken the approach where I may be the only admin for a lot of these things, but in my succession plan, it very clearly says, here are the four critical systems that the school runs on: G Suite, Apple School Manager, our GSS, and our Wi-Fi. And here's how to sysadmin all of those things. Here's where the passwords are. And then finally, like you mentioned before, Bradley, here's a guy to call who knows that you might call him one day, and he knows how to work these systems, and he'll help you out with that. So I suppose those are the key things. Where are your passwords? How do you get into that system? And then who is going to be the person that fixes it all in the short term, or at least will develop the authority to create new admins, for example, or something like that? One other thing that I thought about putting in the succession plan, I don't know if you've done this one, Bradley, is in the plan explicitly name the people who you want to have access to the system. Because if there ever comes like a court case around about your death or your incapacitation, or even if you get fired, right, as well, who is going to have access to all those bits of digital information? Now, say you're dead and you can't express your wish. I found it very helpful to write down who was in there. And I'll tell you who I put in there. It's like my wife, the chairman of the board of the school, and a couple other family members, and nobody else. So it's written down there very clearly who I think should have access to those things. I thought that, I don't know if that's legally binding or whatever, but I thought it might be helpful.
Better than nothing, I guess.
To put that in there. Yeah, yeah. Because I think if you die suddenly, a lot of the stuff that happens after that is based on sort of partial evidence or almost circumstantial evidence about what you might have wanted to happen. But if you write it down clearly, then people can't really argue with who you said you wanted it to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm sure most of our listeners are like opening up Apple Notes and starting to write down some stuff, certainly right now. And so, yeah, that's definitely good. Today is a good place to start documenting that stuff if you have it. That was like one of my goals for this calendar year, was to document critical systems and who should they call. What else do we have here? Now, So I'm definitely concerned about like G Suite. I guess JSS is another one. Website admin, school information system admin. I'm not as concerned about that one, because I feel like someone from our school could get into that account if they needed to. I guess that is my most pressing concerns organizationally. But then just like things on the network, how to get into the Wi-Fi. I mean, again, all those things could be like ripped and replaced if you had to, but it'd be ideal to just have somebody be able to get right in.
I suppose one of the key things we mentioned roughly there, how to store it or where to store it. At the moment I've failed it with the school, but I haven't. I thought, should I get a safe deposit box for it? Not really sure, because, if somebody did have that document, it would let them into literally everything. I mean, that's the point of it, right, is to let somebody else into literally everything that you run. So where and how to keep that secure depends on your circumstances, I suppose, and depends also on your threat level as well. But for most people, it's going to be some kind of safe or something, I guess, maybe. Maybe multiple copies, maybe one on-premise, one off-premise, if you can get an agreement with somebody else that you trust. Obviously, it's got to be somebody you trust as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to make it easy enough to find, but not so easy where it's easy to steal. I mean, paper is easily stolen when you do have the crown jewels and your system to get into everything. I think, you wrote a note here, I think this is true. Keep it up to date. This is something you should revisit quarterly, I think.
Yeah, I think so, because you are going to have some live system information in there. For example, my current succession plan talks about how to get into Aerohive. And in a couple of weeks' time, we're not going to have an Aerohive system anymore. Where does the controller live for our Ubiquiti system? How do you get into that? What's What's the name of the item and 1Password that you want to use to get into that? And also try and keep your 1Password clean as well, because if you've got 700 unused things in there, it's going to be harder for somebody who's probably stressed out and upset to try and find the particular one item they need. So I think another thing that's quite helpful to do in there is to say, to run G Suite, look for this particular item in 1Password. To run Ubiquiti, look for this one item. To run Apple School Manager, this password, and so on. So it sometimes just helpful to write down on the sheet, here are the login names for these accounts. The passwords will be in 1Password so that you don't have too much information in that sheet. But ultimately, that package is going to get people in anyway.
So what else do we have here? Pitfalls.
Two-factor. You mentioned two-factor before.
Yeah, two-factor's tough because that does – again, two-factor for – it's doing what it's supposed to do. And so we had a show about that a few months ago. So if you use SMS codes, they're going to need to make sure you have access to that cell phone. And that in some ways it's easier if it's like a corporate cell phone. But if it's like using an app like Authy or Google Authenticator or 1Password, you're going to need to have somebody to know how to get into that stuff. And this is where, the 1Password for Teams could come in handy, is if you did have the Teams account organizationally and you made sure like all your core systems were in a shared vault.
Yeah, because one of the things is that, let's say you died an untimely death that may have been quite violent in some way, that phone might not exist anymore as well. So that's another good reason not to use SMS, because then you have to go through getting a cloned SIM card and blah, blah, blah. I mean, that can be done, but presumably you're going to need to get a court order for that if it's not you that's asking for the replacement SIM card. So having your two-factor authentication stuff in 1Password is going to help somebody, say that phone is lost or broken beyond repair or something. Having it somewhere else is going to help out as well.
Well, and that's another reason against BYOD for like corporate devices.
Yeah. Yeah, you're kind of trusting that everybody runs a tight enough ship. I mean, if you can have multiple admins, a lot of this problem goes away. But in small schools, many small business situations, you don't have and don't want people that you don't have the technical capabilities to have routine access to those systems as well.
What other pitfalls do we have here? This is where things like Face ID, Touch ID come into handy. Obviously, if there's a PIN code on that device, you want to make sure you know it, or if it's enrolled in an MDM where you can wipe away the PIN code.
Yeah, and maybe a wee bit of instruction about how to do that as well might be helpful. But the thing about, I don't know about you, but I don't put the password for my phone into 1Password. So you got to be aware also of what things are not in 1Password. And I'm kind of aware that one of the big factors would be if somebody needed access to my phone, there would be no way in any of these systems to know what the PIN code was for my phone, because I don't put it in 1Password, for example. So maybe do you put that on the plan, or do you just put it in 1Password so that 1Password becomes the keys to literally everything, including your devices as well?
That's tough. I mean,
I know.
There are pitfalls to both.
Yeah, there are. You got to balance security and convenience here against, business continuity as well. So it's a tricky call, but it's something that you need to sort of work through the whole pathway, if you like, and say, well, if I started from nothing, it's a little bit like the show we had a while ago about, data loss and recovery. If I started with nothing, could I get into the Wi-Fi system here? Could I get into the G Suite, for example? And bizarrely, you want the answer to be yes rather than no in this situation, because it is going to be trusted people. But the question is, where do you keep that? And that's, I don't know if I'm qualified to give that advice to everybody, but you got to make a judgment call on that one.
Yeah. And again, your organizational may spell this out for you, or if you're making it up from scratch, you may be the one to setting the standard for a decade to come on.
Yeah. Getting a fireproof safe might be a good idea.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Anything else?
I think the last thing, Bradley, is just to, I sort of mentioned this earlier, but having an agreement with somebody that you know and trust to be your sort of digital executor, if you like, is probably a good idea. I have a guy who, good friend, who knows that one day he might get the worst phone call ever to say that I've been hit by a bus, and could you please help Cedar School to get the Wi-Fi working again or put a new admin into G Suite. So what I've done in my succession plan as well is to say, if I am killed, you may want to do the following things. And it says things like, add a new super administrator in G Suite, download an archive of my photos from iCloud Photo Library, blah, 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 blah. There's five or six things you might want to do in there. Put a new administrator into Apple School Manager, put a new admin into Ubiquiti, things like that. And just give a sort of guide to everybody as to what you think are the critical systems that need somebody else to take them over, and how do you take them over at that point. So, and of course, you want to trust that it's somebody who will not put themselves in as an admin as well after the fact and sneak into your systems too. So it's got to be somebody who's trusted, but I'm sure we all have at least somebody competent in our world who is trustworthy as well.
Well, you could do that with somebody that's a counterpart at another, you know, where it's like mutually assured destruction.
Yeah, absolutely. That's not a bad idea, is it? Yeah. So, I mean, kind of a morbid topic. I don't know if it's this is what we want to talk about right before the holidays, but I think it's more and more of an issue. It really is.
Well, because it's not as simple as like calling up your bank and the organization making account, adding new people or getting new credit cards. It's like we don't have access to these systems.
And so,
it's kind of giving me. Want to update? It's making me want to go through and like re-update my stuff, make it better, and even maybe think about a counterpart at another school that I could trust everything with as a backup.
Yeah, and there's story after story of people, you know, even just consumers who want access to a dead relative's photos on their iPhone or something, trying to get Apple to unlock their phones, and Apple, you know, pretty steadfastly refusing that without very high levels of authorization, and sometimes even then not saying yes. So just relying on account recovery procedures from companies like Apple and Google is going to be very, very, very difficult. I mean, it's hard enough to help a relative who's forgotten their email password these days. You know, it's even that. I've had that situation a couple of times where people have been like, I don't know my Outlook password. Can you help me? And I'm like, no, not really, because any attempt to recover that password looks like you're being catfished. So it's getting harder and harder to get back into systems without really high levels of authorization. And rightly so. But I think that's why these kinds of planning are much more important than they've ever been before.
This seems like something that they could also be built in, going back to your photos example, be built into like iCloud family sharing, where if like you could provide a death certificate somehow and you were like a person on that account, I don't know, you know what I'm saying? Like where you could prove that they had deceased.
Yeah.
And I don't know. But then Apple still has to build in the back door, or at least the ability to like reset someone else in your family's iCloud password.
Or they could just build in proper family sharing into the photos.
True.
App. That would save the whole problem.
That's actually a great point. And so like one example could be like, let's say you have a Mac, that's always on, or you like, let's say you use iCloud Photo Library on like your iOS devices and Macs, maybe have them back up to your spouse's like Google account to Google Photos.
Yeah. If you can spare the time and space to do that. Yeah, that would work.
So, if you have any thoughts, let us know. This is something that kind of evolves. It's like talking about this has gotten me thinking. Like I've done some stuff, but maybe it's thinking I haven't done enough. And so it's like even think, do I need to like, if I'm ever traveling with my wife, do I need to like make sure my in-laws have access to this stuff? Like I don't know.
That may be something to do with it as well. But if you work for any organization that will survive your individual demise, then probably putting something at work might not be the worst idea.
No, probably not. We'll wrap it up there on a kind of a somber note. Good gosh.
Enjoy your holidays.
Enjoy your holidays. Be safe. Now, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes.com/out of school. Any feedback, get in contact with us at outofschool.net and connect with me on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
Cool. And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web.
Have a good week, everybody.